go over the four steps of that you referred to just recently?
Which I mentioned in the talk.
If you are insulted and you refrain from responding, that is... No, just now.
Yes, just now. Yes, I said it. I don't remember it exactly, but I remember it vaguely. If you are insulted and you force yourself not to answer back and exercise control over you, that's the first step, St. John of the Ladder says. If you not only you have not answered back, but you manage to find some strength to pray for him who has insulted you in order to restore your own peace, is the best way of restoring your own peace, then you're on the second step. The third step, if you feel compassion for the harm his soul suffered in insulting you, is the third step. And the fourth is what we are taught by the Book of the Acts, to rejoice when we are offended for the sake of the Lord. Yes, Father.
Going back to pain, when you use the image of physical pain and then spiritual pain, when you suffer physical pain, how, and maybe you can't answer this, but when the physical pain is such that it's very consumed, how can that not be a distraction?
Yes. Yes, I know. You know, it's not easy. These matters are not easy. And sometimes when the pain because of weeping and repentance becomes too great, it can drown you completely. So then you have to relax a little bit to be able to live. But the criterion is this. If prayer flows, that means there is no harm. That means God is in control of everything. But if pain does not go, you better stop and examine the matters again. In general, as a principle in ascetical life, if we force ourselves and it gets better, that means it's good to keep forcing ourselves. If you force yourself and it doesn't get better, stop, because there may be an organic problem.
But my question was, when one suffers from a disease such as mine...
From
a disease, I have a disease that causes constant pain in my body that's sometimes just absolutely acute and never leaves.
Yes.
How... And it's very difficult at times to be focused on anything other than, like right now, the absolute agony in my neck.
Yes.
How can one pass through that physical pain to find the pain of the soul so that one can then cry out to God in the depths of one's being?
Yes, it's very difficult. But I think if you just, even when you have this physical pain which cannot help you, cannot allow you to concentrate and stay your mind in the heart, is a luxury then. But the pain can become a sacrifice to God if at that moment of pain you say, glory be to thee, O Lord. Glory be to thee, O Lord. Just release this little cry from time to time. Glory be to thee, O Lord. You'll be given grace. The pain will remain, but you'll be given grace that overshadows the pain. I knew a lady who had cancer. She came to the monastery and she told me, she was 60 years old. I have cancer. The doctors told me that in six months I die. I said to her, Andrula, who was her name, Cypriot woman, I said to her, Andrula, then go for the meeting, I said to her, with the Lord. Hold on to his word. Whether we die or live, we are the Lord's. And prepare for this meeting. You have 6 months. Wonderful, I said to her. It's the greatest moment of your life. She was a woman of prayer. I never console people, you live, it will pass. I said, prepare for the meeting, even if they live afterwards. And the woman accepted it. and she started saying, "Glory be to thee, O Lord," all the time. She said, "I want you only to promise to me one thing. When I won't be able to come anymore to the monastery, you come once to see me in the hospital before I die." I said to her, "All right." And before she died, I went twice. The first time I went, she was in pretty bad state, but she was very peaceful. And I said to her, "How are you?" She said, "Glory be to the Lord." She kept saying, "Glory be to thee, O Lord." And she was saying another prayer. I asked her to say, "Lord, I'm thine, save me." Just surrendered to the Lord with this. I said to her, "Lord, I'm thine, save me. And glory be to thee, O Lord, glory be to thee." No other prayer. You don't need any other prayers, I said to her. I went to see her. How are you? She said, "Thanks to God, I'm well." But she was not well, she was dying. After a few weeks, her situation worsened, and they phoned me, and I went. I took communion with me, but I wasn't sure whether I would be able to give her communion. And I go there, and her tummy was like a balloon from the cancer, like that. The only part of the body that was free from the cancer was from the throat up. And I go there and I say, "How are you, Andrula?" Her face was pale but luminous. She started crying. And I said, "Oh my God, I hope she's not faint-hearted." I said, "Why are you crying?" You know what she told me? "Am I worthy to be given such a grace to bear this monstrous thing?" She was in a depth of humility. She couldn't thank worthily God for the grace she was given to bear that terrible cancer. She said, "Am I worthy to be given such a strength to bear this monstrous thing?" She said, "Who am I? Glory be to the Lord." And she said, "My relatives come here thinking to console me, and they disturb my prayer and they don't understand it." "And the Lord is there," he said to me. She pointed to the corner. "And the Lord is there waiting for me." And she left like that, like a lightning, her soul. And after that, I went to the monastery, and the next day I had the liturgy. And three times I had that in my life. It was sounding in my heart, "She's saved, she's saved, she's saved." I could hear it sounding in my heart. And I was crying and I couldn't control myself. I normally control myself because it's not proper for a monk to cry before others. I couldn't control myself and started Simeon, Father Simeon at the monastery, who is the older priest, said to me, "What is the matter with you today?" I said to him, "I just can't control myself. I had such a joy, and the only thing was sounding in my heart, she's saved, she's saved, she's saved." And I had such a beautiful liturgy, and I thank God who gave me the information that she was received as a saint in the kingdom.
Don't mind, one more question.
Yes. I have seen many people come to have such a glorious end with cancer. When they accepted it and they accepted the word of St. Paul, which says, "Whether we live or die, we make it the purpose to be pleasing to God."
So, just to understand, you'd ask, like I said, a personal question. There, when one has that kind of pain, sometimes it's just you can't even put into words the kind of pain one can experience.
I know your pain because I had it with my back for several years.
And to give in to that, and to not fight it, but to accept it. I mean, that's what I've done. I just give up fighting it and accept it, and through it, just simply say, "Thanks be to God." And that's what you're saying, right? That was my question. Is it all right just to give
not,
into it?
It's not to. It's not to give in. But we are led as a sheep to the slaughter. I mean, when we have such a pain, who can you do? But
you can fight it. I know what that's like.
We just remain speechless before the Shearer. We say, glory be to thee, O Lord. Yes.
Just will you comment on two things, please? One is the use of self-flagellation.
This
self-flagellation,
yes,
as has been known at least in the West, and then the other thing is we live in a culture that says utterly the opposite of what you are suggesting, and we are told over and over again that we fight against it. That the disciplines of our culture say you fight against it. The language of the medical discipline is the language of war against pain, war against suffering. And we are bombarded with this whole sort of thing. Television, the whole culture is built this way now. I just ask you to comment.
Yes, but this is the way of the world. But the world is an enmity to God, and we know that the world is an enmity and to God, and whoever loves the world cannot please God. Well, these things are done slowly, slowly by experience. If one tries to do that, forgive me, I'll tell you something. I did a small experiment like that myself. I knew from the writings of the fathers that three things are the most pleasing before God. The first, they say there, is pure prayer, and to do all our works purely. The second is monastic obedience, because that is a total sacrifice. Freedom, which is the most precious thing that man has, lays it at the feet of Christ in monastic obedience. The third is giving thanks in illness and tribulation. And once I went to the hospital to have an operation, and I thought I'll try what the fathers say. And the week after the operation, I was in the convalescing in the hospital. I said no other prayer, but all the time, glory be to thee, O Lord. I thank thee, O Lord, for all things. I didn't want to leave the hospital at the end of the week. It was so beautiful that I didn't want to leave the hospital. So we have to try these things. Taste and see, says the Lord. We make an experiment. You know, in physics, I'll see because I cannot stand on it. In physics, someone, a clever scientist, conceives a theory and makes a hypothesis. And then another scientist, or the same one, carries out experiments to verify this hypothesis. And if...
down on the floor. 1 second.
I'm sorry.
No, they can't see.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
If I go back here, yes. In science, we see that first the scientist forms a hypothesis. Then he or another scientist carries out experiments to verify this hypothesis. And if this hypothesis is verified, then is formulated as a law in physics that governs the relationship of the physical phenomena. That's how we have in physics all the laws. In our faith, in the revelation we received all the revelation of God is given to us in a hypothetical form. You know why? Because God is kind and does not want to constrain our freedom to impose on us. And he says, if you accept my teaching, you will know whence it comes. That is to say, whether it is from a human being or from God, and therefore operates the newness of life, a newness of life. And if you see all the commandments of the Lord and all his word is given as a hypothesis, be still and ye shall know that I am God. If you try stillness, if you make your experiment, then you'll know. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. If we mourn, then we will receive the comfort of the Comforter. So, really, I don't know, I don't have ready these verses, but I told you one. If you receive my teaching, he says the Lord, you'll know whence this teaching comes. All the hypothesis of God is given to us, all the revelation of God, the word of God is given to us as a hypothesis. Really, we can analyze it in a hypothetical form. Not because it's not true, but because God is kind and wants us to make the experiment and prove it and establish it as a law of our life. That's how the commandments of God become a law of our life. We make our experiment and we see that it works. And therefore, his word becomes absolute for us. And that's why it's wrong to classify theology as a theoretical science, as a positive science. It follows exactly the way the positive sciences go, and it's more even medicine, as medicine does. Yes?
We have talked about repentance and sorrow and weeping for sin, but with everything you say, excuse me, I see joy in you.
Sorry?
Joy in you. With everything you say, excuse me, I see great joy.
Yes, you know, and I'm not a good monk myself, I'm a very bad monk. But Father Sofroni told us that when he was on the holy mountain, if the fathers saw a monk to be sullen, depressed, you know what their reaction was? He has not wept in the night. That's why he's sad. If he had wept in the night, he will have joy. He will have squared his accounts with God. He will have received the testimony of his forgiveness in his heart. So the fathers say that if you have not found joy or fire after your prayer, that means you have prayed in an external way, not to say in a Pharisaic way. That's what they say in Philokalia. So these two things go through the cross. Joy has come into the world. It's what we sing: through the cross, joy has come into the world. And that was the main concern of Saint Paul. He didn't try to teach his disciples to make miracles, but he only wanted to teach them Christ and him crucified, because he knew that if they accept Christ and him crucified, they will surely know the power of his resurrection as well, naturally. Yes, Father?
When you talked about the four stages or four steps of forgiving when somebody insults us, if we are not able to do the first step to pray for them, is that comes from pride of the person? from vainglory?
Yes, mainly it's pride. Yes, it's pride, because pride, as Saint Silvan says, and the only is the only obstacle of love and forgiveness.
Father Zachary, when I returned from visiting your monastery last year, not this year, several days before we had our annual retreat, and I shared with the fathers and brothers about my visit with the monastery, and there were some questions, and perhaps you might enlighten us or at least share some with them. The uniqueness of the place of the Jesus Prayer in the community of St. John. I tried to explain it to them, also telling them that it's not automatically exportable, nothing that they ought to try, but that how, as a community, the Elder Sophroni has instituted at St. John that which was common among the hermits on the Holy Mountain.
You know, that came by necessity. Like all the form of the life we have at the monastery, the double community and everything, it was not by plan. It just happened naturally, by providence, I would say. In the beginning, they had no books. There were seven people and seven different nationalities, seven different languages. And praying with the Jesus Prayer, it was the most convenient way. In the beginning, they had no translations even on liturgical books in English, 42 years ago, even not 50 years exactly ago when they started the community in France. And then, but you know how our monastery started? When Father Sophroni left the Holy Mountain, he went to France in order to publish his book on Saint Silvan with the idea to go back to the Holy Mountain after that. He knew that in France there were many Russians, they had printings there, printing presses, they had theological schools, many parishes and so on. The Russian immigration then was flourishing. Many, of course, afterwards came to the New World and left Europe, and it became very small, the immigration, the Russian immigration. But in the beginning, 2 million of Russians went to France after the revolution. So Father Sophroni went to France to publish the book on Saint Silvan, to edit it, and the first edition was with a Renault typer. Yes, by hand he did it. He typed it, he did it, he bound it, he did everything himself. And because he worked very hard under very difficult conditions, he fell ill with ulcer of the stomach, very bad ulcer with terrible hemorrhage, and they had to cut his stomach, extract his stomach, and join the esophagus with the intestine, almost all the stomach. And for many years in the beginning, he couldn't take much food, very little, and rather several times a day. So, after having suffered this handicap, this operation in France, he couldn't go back to the Holy Mountain. He remained captive in a home, in a Russian home of elderly people, in a suburb of Paris, at Saint-Geneviève-des-Bois. There, as soon as he recovered a little bit, there was a chapel in the home, so he started having services. He was a monk. And the old people joined him because they had nothing to do. They had staff, there were staff there to serve them. They had their service and everything, so they joined him. And they had 3 hours of prayer in the morning and 3 hours in the evening. And Father Sophroni taught them to pray the Jesus Prayer. And many of these old people and old women became monks and nuns. And they established a mixed community in the home. And because they had nothing to do all the day, they sat at a round table, and Father Sofroni was teaching them, these old people, spending time in church and around the table. A mixed community emerged like that in a home. But having brought out his book, some young people learned about it, and they began to surround Father Sofroni. The first three monks, Father Irine, Father Simeon, and Father Prokopi, they went near the home, they got the stable, and they made some rooms in the stable, and they spent their day as well in the home. They only slept in the stable. And one of those three was the leader of the chapel of the home, because he was Russian and he could sing beautifully. And so, from the leftovers of the elderly people, they ate as well. And they spent their time with Father Sofroni and in the services and in the home. But after a while, the young people that gathered around, both men and women, they didn't want to continue all their life in a home. They were too young. They were in their 20s to live a whole life in the home. And they began to urge Father Sofroni to make for them a monastery. This was impossible in France because the state is separated from the church, and the state tolerates some monasteries as charity organizations, but not as monasteries as such. In any case, I think it was difficult. They could do it probably if it was God's will. When they started looking into the matter, several friends of Father Sofroni began to look in their own countries, some in Sweden, some in Holland, some in Ireland, some in England. But the lady who was looking for a place for a monastery in England was more able. She was the lady who translated the books of Father Sofroni into English. She was a secretary. She was a secretary in one of the ministries. She was the personal translator of De Gaulle during the war. He met Father Sofroni while he was in the hospital having his operation, and she became connected with him. She became Orthodox then, and then she was the one who found the place for him to go to England. So when Father Sofroni applied to go to England, he was interviewed at the Russian embassy in France, and he said to them, the consul there said to him, "What can you contribute to the life in England? How can you contribute to our life in England?" Father Sofroni said to him, "Will be useless to you. We cannot produce anything. Will be useless to you. But we are seeking for a quiet place to have our liturgy." And the consul said, "Strange people." But they submitted their demand to receive the visa to go to England. And the case of Father Sofroni was discussed in the parliament. And it was a moment when it was a critical moment. It was becoming very tight for foreigners to come to England. And there were, I don't remember all the details, though I have written the story somewhere, but I forgot about it. And it was discussed, and there were some who were adamant not to let this group come into England, because he made a petition to go to England with his Synodia, with his company. There were some who were against, because, and this we have the paper of the government with the minutes, we have it in the archives of the monastery, all this discussion. And one of the members of the parliament got up and said, "You don't let the archimandrite come because they cannot contribute to our economy and to our life. So if the 12 apostles came to Dover, you would only take Judas because he had the money." at that moment, the minister or the home secretary, which it was Butler at that moment, said, "All right." He signed the form and said, "Give the archimandrite whatever he wants." So he got the permission in this miraculous way, and he went back to the community, to the mixed community, and said to them, "You can all come with me to England if you like, but elderly people, secure with a pension in France, having their service and everything, they couldn't migrate to England and start a new adventure, not knowing the language, the way of life there, and so on. They prefer to stay in France." And Father Sofroni left for them a hieromonk, Father Silvan, who continued there the services until 10 years ago. He only died 10 years ago. And the younger group, with two old nuns, went to England. They got this house and they divided it into half. The two old nuns got half of it, and the other half, the three young monks who went with Father Sofroni and Father Sofroni, they only had the old house at that moment. And they lived very quietly and very extremely poorly in the beginning. Their basic diet was potatoes and nettles. I'm ashamed to say that, because now we eat so well at the monastery, but we say it to show how wonderful is the providence of God. Yes, and the first couple of years were very quiet. Nobody knew them, so they had the luxury of having more time for prayer and study and just do their chores very quietly. Real hesychastic life they had for about 2 years. Then they were discovered by the Cypriots, and they started coming in coaches, because they discovered that there is a holy old man there who can confess them, Father Sofroni. So they were the ones who destroyed the silence of the monastery. Father Sofroni received them gladly. He was very happy, but immediately he felt that their life would change now. They needed a place to receive them, so they had to start building. And it was very difficult, because they were in a green belt. They couldn't get easily permission. Though the authorities were extremely clement to us, they wouldn't give permission to English people to build there, and to us they gave. We are very grateful for that. Anyway, the providence of God was wonderful. People started coming in great numbers, and Father Sofroni, from morning until night, he was receiving them in confession. People were very happy. Many lives were restored. And Father Sofroni noticed that the two old nuns were doing great work. They were taking care of the women and the children. So he was completely carefree to receive the people in confession. But when the two old nuns became too old, he had to take one or two younger to look after the old nuns, because the monks couldn't look after the old nuns. So he took a couple of younger ones. Slowly, slowly, without realizing it, a type of community was formed. No plan, it just happened like that. And then they became, I think there were four of the sisters, and they became seven, and it was squashed, the house. But the prayer was very much more strong in those times, and much stronger though in those days than now. But the life very poor, 1 meal a day with a high tea in the afternoon, 1 meal and a high tea. Now we have 3 meals a day, exactly like we normally in the, yes. And we came to a point that it was not, at that moment God gave us to build a house for the sisters. So the old rectory, the old house, was freed from the presence of the sisters, and it was only for the fathers. And the sisters came there only for the meals on the ground floor where there was the refectory and the chapel. Then people began to come again. The sisters became more because there was room in their house. Again we came to an impasse. At that time God gave us opened another door. We built the refectory and where the library is, and the refectory now is the old refectory. For many years it was the new refectory. And we began to breathe again. But then after some years it was impossible. We thought we couldn't manage. And at that moment God gave us the means to buy the farm opposite. And now we are organizing life in a better way. We are going to organize the sisters in the farm opposite, across the road, and all the old property and their house will remain for us. We bought lands, Father Sofroni used to say, when he got that property there, he said, we have bought our lungs now, he said, we can breathe now. So, and he was joking, let's imagine that the road is the river Nile, and one side of the river Nile is the sisters, and on the other side of the Nile River will be the brothers. So, and now at this moment we are building their cells, the house, because some of the sisters moved already to the property because there is a house there, but only six can accommodate, only six. And some, they are still in the house on the other property, on their house there, and even three in one of the guest houses in the village. We have two guest houses in the village for women guests. So you see, I said all that to say that there are no plans in the spiritual life. Providence imposes the plan in our spiritual life, and that is the best way, is the most, because then you have the courage. I remember one day we were flooded by people and we didn't have room to accommodate them, and it was a moment when we were afraid that we won't get the permission to build the hall. And that day I was cook in the old kitchen, and that old kitchen had eight doors, I think. People were entering from every door, and I had to cook at the same time, answer the phone, give something to drink to the people who were arriving. I said to the igumen, I'm sure we'll get the permission for a new building, because look, it is impossible. I said, I'm sure God will make a way for us. The next week it came. Yes, forgive me. And when we go along with the providence, we have courage to struggle, because it is not us who chose it. God put us there. He'll provide home, where he says that the spirits of the prophets obey the prophets. That is to say, if we are truly prophetical, we shouldn't show anything of our inner activity, of our inner life. It's more humble not to show anything, so that we can keep the humility, which is precious, and also not to provoke the conscience of our fellows. That's why in the church, the whole culture of the church is like that. In the church, we don't do anything to provoke attention. If we are provoking attention, that means it's not right. The reading we do in the church is on a neutral tone, so that the people of God who are present, they can hear it if they want, and they can disengage if they want, to follow their own rhythm of inner prayer. This is the culture. That's why we say, have mercy upon me, O God, after the great love, and so If I want, I hear it is there. If I'm tired to pray, I listen to that. But if I spend the night in prayer and I have a different rhythm within me, I'm not forced to follow that. I have my own rhythm, and I don't provoke anybody. So we do everything in order to protect our humility and to protect the conscience of our fellows. That's why in the Orthodox Church, the truly charismatic people don't show anything. In the West, may God forgive me, I don't want to criticize, may God forgive me for what I say, but I think they are not free from the lust for power, the charismatic people. And sometimes they are their graces and their gifts in order to dominate their fellows. Forgive me for that. And that is madness and destruction, as the Lord said to the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Forgive me, Bishop Isa. I spoke too much. No, don't clap, it doesn't help me though.